Here a main audiobook of the Velikovsky book. In the beginning. Preface. I have been asked by the compilers of the Velikovsky archive to briefly describe the present condition of Velikovsky's unpublished manuscript entitled, In the Beginning. As Velikovsky explains, parts of this volume were already complete in the 1940s and originally formed part of Worlds in Collision. The present manuscript also incorporates material written for a volume entitled The Test of Time, which dealt with the new information on the planets coming from the space probes, and contained frequent allusions to the earlier catastrophes. This work will probably never see publication. Other material included in this manuscript comes from Velikovsky's lectures and other scattered writings. During the time that I worked for Velikovsky, 1976 to 1978, one of my tasks was to complete the cataloging of his library notes, mostly from the 1940s. The headings of the catalog generally corresponded to the section headings in Worlds in Collision and In the Beginning. The completion of In the Beginning was a cooperative effort between Velikovsky and myself. After Velikovsky's passing, when I returned to Princeton to work on his archive, I systematically moved the parts contributed by me into the notes apparatus, and this is how this material appears in the unpublished manuscript. Jan Sammer. Introduction. This volume carries the name In the Beginning, the words with which the book of Genesis starts. The name seems appropriate because it describes the cosmic events which are narrated in the first book of the Hebrew Bible, but also because in it I speak of events that preceded those described by me in Worlds in Collision. Thus the name of the book conveys to the reader the notion that here is an earlier history of the world compared with the story of Worlds in Collision. Although it is the second volume in that series, in some sense it is the first volume, being the earlier story. When the manuscript of Worlds in Collision was first offered to the publisher, Macmillan Company, New York, it contained a brief story of the deluge and of the cataclysm that terminated the Old Kingdom in Egypt. But after one of the publisher's readers suggested that the book should concentrate on one event, we compromised in presenting in the published volume two series of cataclysms, those that took place in the 15th century before the present era and were caused by the near approaches of Venus, and those that occurred in the 8th century before this era and were caused by the near approaches of Mars. The unused material was left for elaboration in a separate work on Saturn in the Flood and Jupiter of the Thunderbolt. The reception of Worlds in Collision, however, made me understand that I had already offered more than was palatable. And so I did not hurry with what I consider to be the heritage of our common ancestors, an inheritance of which my contemporaries in the scientific circles preferred not to partake. Researching and writing this book, I would sit at the feet of the sages of many ancient civilizations, one day of the Egyptian learned scribes, another of the Hebrew ancient rabbis, the next of the Hindus, Chinese, or the Pythagoreans. But then, rising to my feet, I would confer with present-day scientific knowledge. At times I came to understand what perplexed the ancients, and at other times I found answers to what perplexes the moderns. This shuttle back and forth was a daily occupation for a decade or more, and it became a way to understand the phenomena, to listen to those who lived close to the events of the past, even to witnesses, and to try to understand them in the light of the theoretical and experimental knowledge of the last few centuries, in this manner confronting witnesses and experts. I realized very soon that the ancient sages lived in a frightened state of mind, justified by the events they or their close ancestors had witnessed. The ancients' message was an anguished effort to communicate their awe engendered at seeing nature with its elements unchained. The moderns, however, denied their ancestors' wisdom, even their integrity, because of an all-embracing fear of facing the past. Even their historically documented experiences of our progenitors, as recent as 80 generations ago. I have deliberately described the catastrophes of the second and first millennia before this era before I describe the catastrophes of the previous ages. The reason is obvious: the history of catastrophes is extremely unsettling to the historians, evolutionists, geologists, astronomers, and physicists. Therefore it is preferable to start from the better known and then proceed to the less known. For the last catastrophe caused by the contact of Mars and the Earth, I could establish the year, the month, and even the day. Not so for the catastrophes in which Venus and the Earth participated, when only the approximate time in the space of a definite century could be established. Still, I found it advisable to narrate the story of the second millennium first. It was possible to write the story of the contacts with Venus with a fair amount of detail. But each cataclysm is not only more remote in time from us, it is also obscured by the catastrophes that followed. As we seek to penetrate ever deeper into the past, we can see the foregoing periods through the veil of the catastrophes. Dimmer and dimmer is the light behind every veil, till our eye can distinguish no more behind the veil that hangs over the period when the Earth was moonless, though already inhabited by human life. We do not know the beginning, we can only enter the theater at what may have been the third or fourth act. The Hebrew cosmogony. This world came into existence out of a chaos of fluid driven by a divine blast. This is the epic beginning of the book of Genesis. The earth was chaotic and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep, and God's wind moved upon the face of the fluid. From this primeval matter, in a process of subsequent creations, was born the home of the living. Already before the birth of our earth, worlds were shaped and brought into existence, only to be destroyed in the course of time. Nor is this world inhabited by man the first of things earthly created by God. He made several worlds before ours, but he destroyed them all. The earth underwent reshaping, six consecutive remoldings. Heaven and earth were changed in every catastrophe. Six times the earth was rebuilt, without entire extirpation of life on it, but with major catastrophes. Six ages have passed into the great beyond. This is the seventh creation, the time in which we live. According to another tradition, several heavens were created, seven in fact. Also seven earths were created, the most removed being the seventh Eras, followed by the sixth Adama, the fifth Arkar, the fourth Haraba, the third Yabasha, the second Tebel, and our own land called Held, and like the others, it is separated from the foregoing by abyss, chaos, and waters. The description permits an interpretation that all the seven earths exist simultaneously, but a deeper insight will allow us to recognize that the original idea did not admit seven concurrent but separate firmaments and worlds in space, but only consecutive in time, and built one out of another. The seven heavens form a unity, the seven kinds of earth form a unity, and the heavens and the earth together also form a unity. The Hebrew cosmogony in its true sense is a conception of worlds built and reshaped with the purpose of bringing creation closer to perfection. The separation of one world from another by abyss and chaos evidently refers to the cataclysms that separated the ages. Remark. The notion of a succession of worlds created and destroyed is common to many nations of antiquity. Vicentius San Germano, Cosmographia Burmana, quoted by F. Buchanan, On the Religion and Literature of the Bmas, Asiatic Researches, wrote, "The universe is called by the Bmas Loga, which signifies successive destruction and reproduction. The Burma writings do not conceive of one world, but of an infinite number, one constantly succeeding another, so that when one is destroyed, another of the same form and structure arises." Planet ages. The ages of the past, between the successive catastrophes, are called in many diverse sources sun ages. I have tried to show why this designation is meaningful. But the ancients also maintained that the successive ages were initiated by planets: Moon, Saturn, Mercury, Jupiter, Venus, Mars. Therefore the sun ages could also have been called planet ages. Hesiod ascribed the Golden Age to the time when the planet Saturn was ruling, and the Silver and Iron Ages to the time of the planet Jupiter. The same concept is found in Virgil, who says that before Jove's day, that is, in the Golden Age when Saturn reigned, no tillers subdued the land, even to mark the field or divide it with bounds was unlawful. The idea that the Earth was under the sway of different planets at different ages is also the teaching of the Pythagoreans, the Magi, Gnostic sects, and other secret societies. In numerous astrological texts, the same concept is repeated, that seven millennia were dominated by seven planets, one after the other. The worshippers of the devil, the Syrian sect of the Yazidis, believed that 7,000 years had passed since the deluge. At the end of every millennium, one of the seven planet gods descends on the earth, establishes a new order and new laws, and then retreats to his place. An identical tradition is found in the writings of Julius Africanus. The ages of the ancestors passed under the government of the planets, each in its turn. Also, according to the Ethiopian text of the first book of Enoch, the seven world ages were each dominated by one planet. The Gnostic sect of the Mandaeans taught in its holy book Sidera that the history of mankind is composed of seven epochs, that these epochs were terminated by catastrophes, and that one of the planets ruled in each epoch. The length of the ages in the Sidera is made very long, but the concept is, nevertheless, common to many ancient creeds. Sabbath. The idea of naming the days of the week in honor of the seven planets was, according to Eusebius, introduced by the Persians at the time of the war of Xerxes against Greece. Dio Cassius, the Roman author of the 4th century, wrote that the division of the week into 7 days in honor of the seven planets originated with the Egyptians, and then spread to other peoples. Even today, the names of the days of the week in European languages can be traced to the names of the planets. Thus the Roman dies solis, sun, or Sunday, is Sonntag in German, dies luni, moon, or Monday, is lundi in French, and montag in German, dies martis, Mars, or Tuesday, is mardi in French and mars in Spanish, dies jovis, Jupiter, or Thursday, is jeudi in French and donnerstag in German, Friday is dies veneris, Venus, or vendi in French, while Saturday is dies saturnis, the day of Saturn. The naming of the 7 days of the week in honor of the seven planets is not only an act of reverence apportioned to these gods, but also a memorial to the seven ages that were governed by each of the seven planets in succession. This idea can be traced in the establishment of the Jewish week with its Sabbath. Although the social significance of the Sabbath as the universal day of rest for man, his servant, and the domestic animal working for him is so apparent from many passages in the scriptures and especially from the beneficent application of a weekly day of rest by all civilized nations that took this precept from the Hebrew Bible, the cosmological meaning of the Sabbath must not remain overlooked. In six ages the world and mankind went through the pangs of Genesis or creation with its metamorphoses. It is not by mistake that the ages which were brought to their end in the catastrophes of the deluge, of the confusion of languages or of the overturning of the plain, are described in the book of Genesis. The time of Genesis or creation was not over until the Sabbath of the universe arrived. With the end of the world age simultaneous with the end of the Middle Kingdom and the Exodus, the Sabbath of the universe should have begun. The destruction of the world in the days of the Exodus closed, in the conception of the Hebrews, the age of creation. It was to signify the end of the time when the earth and men were to be shaped and reshaped. The traditional and very old Hebrew prayer at the beginning of the Sabbath opens with these words, "The sixth day, and the heavens and the earth were established. And the Lord finished in the seventh day the entire work that he did and rested from all the work that he did." The meaning of this passage is that in six world ages the heavens and the earth were finally established, and that now, in the seventh age, no further changes in the cosmic order should be expected. The Lord is actually implored to refrain from further reshaping the earth. The idea that God's day is a millennium is often met in Talmudic literature. The Apostle Peter also says, "One day is with the Lord as a thousand years." Thus the 7 days of the week represent seven world ages, and the day of the Sabbath represents the seventh world age, which is our age. According to the rabbis of the Tractate Shagbat of the Babylonian Talmud, Sabbath is to be interpreted as Sabbatu, cessation of the divine wrath. This fits exactly our idea of the Sabbath as the age of rest when the heavens and the earth are established and are not to be disturbed again. Many exegetes have wondered as to why the prayer of benediction to the Sabbath starts with the words, "the sixth day," expecting to find there the words "the seventh day." The words "the sixth day" are not necessarily wrong here, The meaning may be that with the expiration of the sixth age the heaven and the earth become unchangeable. But it may be that the prayer originated in pre-Exodus days when only six ages were counted. The prayer next refers to the Sabbath as the day of rest, the memorial to the act of Genesis, because this day is the beginning of the reckoning of days, memory of the Exodus from Egypt. The assembling of three different causes for the establishment of the Sabbath would appear confusing were it not for the fact that the three occurrences were simultaneous: the last act of creation, the new flow of time, the Exodus from Egypt. Although after the beginning of the seventh age new world catastrophes disrupted the established order, in the 8th and 7th centuries before the present era, the idea of the Sabbath of the universe was already so deeply rooted that the new world catastrophes were not counted, so as not to discredit the establishment of the Sabbath. But the return of the sun's shadow 10 degrees in the days of Hezekiah and Isaiah was registered as the seventh world wonder, and thus actually the eighth world age started. The difference in the magnitude of the catastrophes caused also some nations of antiquity to count 6, 7, as most nations, or 8, or 9, or even 10 ages, one and the same people, like the Mayas, had traditions of 5 and 7 ages in diverse books of theirs. Also, catastrophes recurring at short intervals, as those which took place in the 8th and beginning of the 7th century before the present era, could be regarded as the closing of one age, or a few short additional ages could be conceived. Catastrophes, variable as they were in their magnitude and consequences, could have had a subjective appraisal. Even an encounter of the Earth with a lesser comet, which appeared very bright, in the days when Octavian Augustus observed the mortuary activities in honor of Julius Caesar, and which dispersed its gases in the atmosphere of the Earth, was regarded by one contemporary author as the end of a world age and the beginning of a new one, although no perceptible changes in the motion of the Earth and no greater calamity than a year-long gloom were observed. The Sabbath being a day of rest in the social order, its cosmic meaning in the great fear of the end of the world can be suspected also in view of the rigor with which it was observed. At the beginning of the Christian era, members of some sects among the Jews would not even move, and would remain in the place and position in which the beginning of the Sabbath found them. Social institutions are generally not observed with such an awe and with such rigor. It was actually not the deity, having worked during six ages and reposed in the seventh, who gives example to man. It is man, by abstaining from work on the seventh day, the symbol of the seventh world age, who invites the Supreme Being to keep the established order of the heaven and earth, and not to submit them to new revolutions. The same idea is found in the prayer of the Chinese Emperor Shun, who lived shortly after the Emperor Yao. This prayer, declaimed by him, reads: "The sun and moon are constant, the stars and other heavenly bodies have their motions, the four seasons observe their rule." A number of centuries thereafter, in the days of the Emperor Kui, the order of the celestial sphere was again disrupted, the planets went out of their courses. Also Hebrew psalmists and prophets tried to suggest to nature to abstain from revolt, but at the same time they expressed their fear of changes in the future comparable to those in the past. After more than 2,500 years, one of the two original ideas of the Sabbath, its cosmic meaning, was lost to mankind, leaving the social idea conscious and triumphant the world over. Deification of the planets. The sun and the moon are two great luminaries, and it is easily understandable that the imagination of the peoples should be preoccupied with them and should ascribe to them mythological deeds. Yet the ancient mythologies of the Chaldeans, the Greeks, the Romans, the Hindus, the Mayans, preoccupied themselves not with the sun or the moon, but prima facie with the planets. Marduk, the great god of the Babylonians, was the planet Jupiter, so was Amun of the Egyptians, Zeus of the Greeks and Jupiter of the Romans. It was much superior to Shamash Helios, the sun day. Why was it revered by all peoples? Why was the planet Mars chosen to be the personification of the god of war? Why did Cronos of the Greeks, Saturn of the Romans, play a part in hundreds of myths and legends? Thoth of the Egyptians, Nebo and Nergal of the Babylonians, Mithra and Mazda of the Persians, Vishnu and Shiva of the Hindus, Huitzilopochtli and Quetzalcoatl of the Mexicans were personifications of planets. Innumerable hymns were dedicated to them and adventures and exploits ascribed to them. The life of our planet has its real source in the sun, wrote E. Renan. All force is a transformation of the sun day before religion had gone so far as to proclaim that God must be placed in the absolute and the ideal, that is to say, outside of the world. One cult only was reasonable and scientific, and that was the cult of the sun day. But the sun was subordinate to the planets, even though they are not conspicuous, poor sources of light, and no sources of warmth. The night sky illuminated by stars is majestic. The geometrical figures of the constellations, such as the Pleiades, Orion, or the Great Bear, rolling from the east in the evening to the west before morning, are favorite motifs in poetry, no less than the sun and the moon. But the discrepancy in the choice of motifs by the ancients becomes still more obvious. The constellations of the sky took only a minor and incidental part in the mythology of the ancient peoples. The planets were the major gods, and they rule the universe. It is not easy to understand the idea which was the basis for the identification of the Babylonian gods with the planets, writes an author, but the same process of identification of major gods with the planets can be found in the religions of the peoples in all parts of the world. The planets were not affiliated to the gods, or symbols of the gods, they were the gods. In prayers and liturgies they were invoked as gods. The greater gods, even when addressed by name in prayer, were regarded as astral powers. This or that planet is selected, according to the text of the prayer, from the multitude of the stars of heaven to receive a gift. The planetary gods are much the most powerful of all. Their positions in the sky, their reciprocal relations, have a decisive influence on all physical and moral phenomena of the world. The great majority of us moderns pay no attention to these points in the night sky, and probably not one in ten or even in a hundred is able to point to Jupiter or Mars in the firmament. The planets change their places, but not conspicuously. Were they indebted for their deification to this slow movement, by which they differ from the fixed stars? Did Zeus Jupiter Marduk-Amun become the supreme deity, the thunderer and dreadful lord of the universe, only because of his slow movement? He passes in 12 years the circle of the zodiac, traversed by the sun in 24 hours, and by the moon even quicker? When seen with the naked eye, the planet Jupiter distinguishes itself from the fixed stars of first magnitude only by this slow change of position. Augustine, confused by the problem of the deification of the planets, wrote in the 4th century, "But possibly these stars which have been called by their names are these gods. They call a certain star Mercury, and likewise a certain other star Mars. But among those stars which are called by the name of gods, is that one which they call Jupiter, and yet with them Jupiter is the world. There also is that one they call Saturn, and yet they give him no small property beside, namely all seeds. Mercury, the closest to the sun, is barely visible, being hidden in the sun's rays. But the ancients made the planet Mercury into a great god, Hermes or Nebo. Why was it feared and worshipped? What is there generally in the planets to inspire awe, so as to influence people to build temples for them, to sing liturgies, to bring sacrifices, to narrate legends, and to dedicate to them the domain of science, of war, of agriculture? The ancients were sufficiently enlightened to know that the planets are large rocks like the Earth that circle on orbits. And this makes the modern scholars wonder, knowing that the planets are rocks, why did the ancients believe that they are gods? The key to this problem, which is the major problem of all classical mythology, is already in our hands. The planet Venus was deified because of its dramatic appearance and because of the havoc it brought to the world, as described in Worlds in Collision. I illuminated also the events which made Mars a feared god. Divine qualities were ascribed to the other planets because of the catastrophes they wrought in earlier ages. In the Persian holy books it is said that on the planets depends the existence or non-existence of the world, wherefore are they especially to be venerated. The seven planets rule the universe, says an Abatian inscription. The Greeks and Romans believed that everything is, in fact, subject to the changes brought about by the revolutions of the stars. The celestial orbs by their combined movements are the authors of all that was, and is to come. According to ancient Hebrew traditions, there are seven archangels, each of whom is associated with a planet. The seven archangels are believed to play an important part in the universal order through their associations with the planets. The reason for the deification of the planets lay in the fact that the planets only a short time ago were not faultlessly circling celestial bodies, nor were they harmless. This is also expressed in a Mandaean text, "How cruel are the planets that stay there and conspire evil in their rage. The planets conspire in rage against us. Uranus." The seven planets of the ancients comprise the Sun, the Moon, Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. However, the ancients' religions and mythology speak for their knowledge of Uranus, the dynasty of gods, had Uranus followed by Saturn, and the latter by Jupiter. In the clear sky of Babylonia, the planet Uranus could have been observed by an unaided eye, but since it was known as a deposed deity, it would seem that at some later time the planet lost much of its brightness. It is quite possible that the planet Uranus is the very planet known by this name to the ancients. The age of Uranus preceded the age of Saturn. It came to an end with the removal of Uranus by Saturn. Saturn is said to have emasculated his father Uranus. Behind this story there might have been a scene in the sky. In one theory of the origin of the solar system, a side-swiping star tears out from the Sun a long filament of gaseous material. Similarly, Saturn may at one time have emasculated Uranus. Saturn was represented by the Romans with a sickle in his hands. Circumcision may have originated as an emulation of the acts displayed in the sky, when it appeared that Saturn with a sickle emasculated Uranus. The Egyptians, and so also the Hebrews, introduced circumcision, the removal of the foreskin being pars per toto, or instead of castration. It is not unthinkable that sometime before the age the record of ancient civilizations reaches, Uranus, together with Neptune, Saturn and Jupiter, formed a quadruple system that was captured by the Sun and from which the planets of the solar system had their origin. But here nothing but imagination takes over where tradition based on witnessing does not reach. According to Hesiod, the catastrophe described as the removal of Uranus by Saturn gave birth to Aphrodite. In Worlds in Collision, Aphrodite was identified with the Moon. The Earth without the Moon. The period when the Earth was moonless is probably the most remote recollection of mankind. Democritus and Anaxagoras taught that there was a time when the Earth was without the Moon. Aristotle wrote that Arcadia in Greece, before being inhabited by the Helms, had a population of Pelasgians, and that these aborigines occupied the land already before there was a moon in the sky above the earth. For this reason they were called Proscians. Apollonius of Rhodes mentioned the time when not all the orbs were yet in the heavens, before the Danaean and Deucalion races came into existence, and only the Arcadians lived, of whom it is said that they dwelt on mountains and fed on acorns, before there was a moon. Plutarch wrote in the Roman Questions, "There were Arcadians of Evander's following, the so-called pre-lunar people." Similarly wrote Ovid, "The Arcadians are said to have possessed their land before the birth of Jove, and the folk is older than the moon." Hippolytus refers to a legend that Arcadia brought forth Pelasgus, of greater antiquity than the moon. Lucian in his Astrology says that the Arcadians affirm in their folly that they are older than the moon. Censorinus also alludes to the time in the past when there was no moon in the sky. Some allusions to the time before there was a moon may be found also in the scriptures. In Job 25:5, the grandeur of the Lord who makes peace in the heights is praised and the time is mentioned before there was a moon and it did not shine. Also in Psalm 72:5 it is said, "Thou wast feared since the time of the sun and before the time of the moon, a generation of generations." A generation of generations means a very long time. Of course, it is of no use to counter this sum with the myth of the first chapter of Genesis, a tale brought down from exotic and later sources. The memory of a world without a moon lives in oral tradition among the Indians. The Indians of the Bogota Highlands in the eastern Cordilleras of Colombia relate some of their tribal reminiscences to the time before there was a moon. In the earliest times, when the moon was not yet in the heavens, say the tribesmen of Chibchas,